So if you've got your Bibles, go to Nehemiah. If you've not, we'll have it up on the screen, although I'm still a bit old school. I like to have the page open so I can look, just make sure I'm not fudging. It's there written in front of me. Remember, I meant last time I spoke was 2 weeks ago in Nehemiah chapter 4, which the opening statement was, trust God but keep your powder dry. Well, this week Nehemiah needs to keep his powder because he's full on in opposition mode. And someone once said that there are three kinds of people in the world. There are those that don't know what's happening, there are those that who watch what's happening, and there are those that make things happen. And Nehemiah is one of those people that hears the word of the state of the nation, is moved by that, and is not happy to sit back and just watch what happens. He moves on that. And so we see the building of this, rebuilding of the wall. And that's the first part that we're looking at, and we finish in chapter 6 today, and then we look at the idea of restoring and renewing. So just for by way of background, if you're visiting with us today or you've been on holidays, you've missed a couple of messages, just to give you some background, some recurring themes through the book of Nehemiah. It's a neat little book. It's only 13 chapters. It's really alongside the book of Malachi, which is just before there's 400 years of gap between the Old Testament and the New Testament. So Israel or Judah, which is the two tribes in the south, have been captives in Babylon for something like 70 years, and they're coming back. And so some of the recurring themes is this concept of prayer, and prayer bookends Nehemiah at the start and at the finish. And Nehemiah is just undergirded with prayer, and some of them are a little bit longer. Some of those little short sentences, God, I need help. Yeah, any of you utter those sorts of prayers? You'll find those in the book of Nehemiah. They're neat. The other one is the power of repentance. Once he receives the news of what's happening back there, not only does he repent for the sins of the people, he repents for his own sins as well, because the people were in captivity because of their disobedience. And God had said through Isaiah, Jeremiah, other prophets, unless you straighten up, another nation I will bring in that's going to take you captive. And they didn't listen to the word of God. They were taken captive. And so now they're on looking at returning and from exile, which is that one. Also, conflict. There's internal and external. We've looked at the likes of Tobiah and others. External conflict or opposition. And then there was internal. There were Jews that were taking advantage of of the poor within Israel. They're ripping them off with their loans and mortgages and that sort of thing. Riley just nailed it last week. I just love the message that he brought with us, dealing with what was going on internally in the nation from chapter 5. Also, there's this theme of the heart of God for the marginalized, which we see come out in a number of places. Serving in the public square. You ever wondered what it's like to be a follower of God and serve in a public space? Read the book of Nehemiah. He's a cupbearer to the king, an incredibly elevated position of trust. He's also a governor, and he's a little bit like Daniel from earlier on. So Nehemiah gives us a bit of a clue on what it is to be a Christian in a public working place. Also, spiritual renewal. This is what I love about Nehemiah. Sometimes we limit it to be thinking that it's just about building a wall. So it's a sort of book that you look at when you're in a building program. if you do that, you just fall short of what Nehemiah is about. It's much more than that, particularly about restoring and renewing. And there's this idea, this concept of the good hand of God, where Nehemiah points back to God just overarching the whole story and superintending stuff and the sovereignty of God. And so there's this little phrase, the good hand of God, and the way that Nehemiah just flicks that back to where good things are taking place or where things are taking place. He says the good hand of God. And we've seen that here in this church. So just some great themes that run through. Again, by way of review, because some will miss it. If you do miss bits, just get online and you can download the sermons. The nation of Judah, the two tribes in the south, remember the 10 tribes that were up here? They were taken captive, about 722 BC by the Assyrians and destroyed and assimilated into the other nations, never to be seen again. But the two tribes in the south were disobedient, taken captive to Babylon, there for 70 years, and they're on the way back, and they come back in waves. They come back in waves. One of the waves was with Ezra, and they saw the rebuilding of the temple in Jerusalem. And now under Nehemiah, we're seeing the rebuilding of the wall. So the significant thing about chapter 6 is that it gets really personal. And the opposition goes to a neck level. And it is. They are wanting to take him out. And they're wanting to literally kill him. And it's an incredible level of intimidation. That's the method that they use. So you see three schemes of intimidation in this chapter. The gossip and rumor, also accusations, discrediting, and then intimidation. In fact, the structure in chapter 6 is so neat and tidy that it's at the end of each of those sections, like the end of verse 9, you see there a particular phrase, which is the phrase that we get intimidation from. Some of your translations will have intimidation. Some of you will have to frighten us. Or at the end of verse 14, it's to make us afraid. And the end of verse 19 is intimidation. It's really neat, the three sections of chapter 6 as it falls into place there. So let's have a look at the first one. What I'll try and do in this is, because this is 2,500 years ago, so how does, and not all of us are leading a nation of people to rebuild a wall. Any of you done that lately? Yeah, that's what I thought. I mean, I built a dry stone wall once, but that was a long time ago and I didn't have opposition. I just had to shift a lot of rocks. So how do we bring this into where we are today without over-spiritualizing it? So we'll be looking at some ways of application as we work our way through. And I know already we're not going to get there. Okay, so that's all right. We've got plenty for next week. Nehemiah chapter 6, verse 1 through 9. Sanballat, Tobiah, Geshem the Arab, and the rest of our enemies. Don't you love that start? And if you've been here with us before, you'll see that Jerusalem sits here, and the enemies are north, west, east, and south. They surround Jerusalem. And so verse 1 says, Sanballat, Tobiah, Geshem the Arab, and the rest of our enemies found out that I had finished rebuilding the wall and that no gaps remained. It was like, yes, they got it done. But they had not yet set up the doors and the gates. Around the walls of Jerusalem, there were gates and doors. They hadn't got that done yet. So there was still a bit of a gap, so the city wasn't secure. And that's a bit of a, for us to get our heads around that, because we're not used to living in towns with walls around it. I think the gardeners have just come back. They've been over in England and Scotland, and you'll see castles and places like that. The closest thing that we've got is a fence around our house, although for most places you don't have a front fence anymore, do you? But it's like, this is like a city that didn't have a fence all around it. And in those days, it was really important to have a fence because, one, it kept everyone else out, the enemy, so you close it at night time. And secondly, it also demonstrated to the nations around you of the nature of your God, the powerful nature of your God. And at the moment, Judah's God, Israel's God, was a God that looked insipid, because the holy city, where the temple was, where previously the Shekinah glory had dwelt in that temple, not this one, a previous one, this was the holy city of God, was still in rubble. So that's what moved the heart of Nehemiah. So they hadn't quite finished it all up. So they got one last chance to destroy this work. And so verse 2 says, so Sanballat and Geshem sent a message asking me to meet them at one of the villages on the plain of Ono. But I realized they were plotting to harm me. He didn't trust this mob. And he might have had the gift of discernment, I'm not sure. But he says, there's no way I'm going down there. And so they're trying to harm him. It was obvious. Verse 3, so I replied by sending this message to them. I'm engaged in a great work, so I can't come. Why should I stop working to come and meet you? Four times they sent the same message, and each time I gave the same reply. The fifth time, Sanballat's servant came with an open letter in his hand. And this is what it said. There is a rumor. Anytime you hear that. There is a rumor among the surrounding nations, and Geshem tells me it's true, that you and the Jews are planning to rebel, and that is why you're building the wall. According to his reports, you plan to be king. Now, there's an element of truth there, isn't there? Because there are prophecies in the Old Testament. In fact, if you had your Bibles and you looked at Haggai and Zechariah, it said in both those books that down the future, look, there is a king in Judah. It's actually messianic because, let me back up a bit, from the nation of Israel would come the Messiah. Genesis chapter 12, out of you all the nations of the world will be blessed. How can that happen if they're in exile? That God's bringing them back to Jerusalem. And out of that eventually would be a king in the city. Out of the tribe of Judah. Nation of Israel. And he would be king. So there is a sense that this rumor is true. But it wasn't with worthy cause that Tobiah and his mates are making reference to this. He also reports that you have appointed prophets in Jerusalem to proclaim about you. Look, there is a king in the land. You can be very sure that this report will get back to the king. So I suggest to you to come and talk it over with me. Let's have a conversation. I wouldn't trust him as far as I could kick them, and neither would Nehemiah. And he never went. They kept asking. He kept sending back the message, no, I'm not coming. And the method that they were using had already worked. What they were saying is that they're charging with Nehemiah very close to sedition. In other words, that he's going to rebel against his old boss. Who was who? Who was his old boss? Art. You can call him Art. Artaxerxes was his old boss. He was a cupbearer for the king. And what they're saying is that you're sending up prophets throughout the land. This is the rumor. This is the gossip that's going on, the chatter that these guys are doing. By the way, if you read to the end of this chapter, you'll see that one of the reasons they've got inroads inside the wall is because of marriages and political alignment. And so you've got some connection with those inside the wall, and these guys are sending messages inside there that is gossip and rumor and innuendo with the view to bringing down Nehemiah. So in this work before, if you read the book of Ezra, they did it there. They got the temple built, they started rebuilding the wall, and they began to send messages back to Artaxerxes to say, these guys rebuilding the wall are going to rebel against you, and they're going to raise up their own king. So Artaxerxes wrote a decree and said, shut down the build, stopped it. Until about 80 years later when Nehemiah comes along and starts building the wall again. So this gossip, this rumor that is going on, which was directly straight at Nehemiah. Now, here's the question for us today. What do you do when you hear a rumor? Or where you come across some good goss? What do you do with that? What was that?
Pass it on.
Yeah, I love your honesty. You know, there's another way that we can do, because this was going to destroy Nehemiah and the work. And it was insidious. It was sending out rumors, and there was a truth in what was going out. If I mentioned to you, when we talk about rumors and gossip, you've got someone already in your head that you're thinking of. Agree? If I were to say to you, okay, rumor and gossips, who are the gossips in your head that you can think of? Well, maybe it's just my twisted head. I can think of folk that's That's how they do it. When we go back to Victoria, where we lived for over 10 years, and we got good friends over there, and we just still connected, I'll ring up the phone, I'll ring someone over there and say, "So can you tell us the goss?" And what I'm asking for is not the gossip, but I'm asking, I want to be informed, who's died, who's got married, who's having babies, who's left Kerrang, who's moved in, how's the church going? That's the thing. But the key thing is when I ask how's the goss, it's not out of a sense of a negative spirit with a bent on hurting somebody else through either misinformation or misapplied information. So the sense of gossip, I'm not getting pleasure out of having someone sharing negative views. Gossip is, and if we had our children still in here, I had a little image for them, is gossip and rumors. All of us have been in that setting, only with Nehemiah, you probably take him out of there, where others are taking the mick out of them. It's behind their back, it's innuendo. It may be true, it may not be true, but it's with a negative sense, and you see the tears there, it ends badly. The idea of gossip is information about someone that is shared with others that is not motivated by good. Information, and it's often disparaging information about someone that is shared with others that is not motivated by doing good to them. That's what's taking place here. These people weren't interested in Nehemiah's well-being. And so they were making up stories and gossiping it and sharing it with the view to taking down Nehemiah and ultimately the nation and the wall and the mission of God. So it was no small thing. So what do we do with that? This is stuff that is not helpful. Again, it's not limited by false statements, but it is always on the idea of negative. Another pastor, Ray Ortland, has written on this, and he said, "It creates a social environment of suspicion where everyone must wonder what is being said behind their backs and whether appearances of friendship is sincere." You know, you add social media into this, and it's a minefield. It ruins hard-won reputations with cowardly but effective weapons of misrepresentation. It manipulates people into taking sides. That's a word, manipulation. And these guys were trying to manipulate through gossip and rumor and slander. And by the way, if you look at Romans chapter 1, the description there about the ungodly, those two words are used, gossipers and slanderers. Now, when was the last time you had someone come under church discipline because of gossip? I can't remember any. I remember some church meetings, sadly, dealing with sexual sin in the church, and that's addressed because that's a biggie. Gossip? Romans 1 links that behavior with ungodliness. So what do you do when you get gossip and slander? Let me give you a couple of suggestions, because I think this helps ground what was Nehemiah's experience into our experience. By the way, I find this a hard one, because sometimes it can be from a friend. Sometimes it can be from an unexpected space. And I think, gee, what do I do with that? Do I push back into that? How do I respond? And some of you, I've been off social media since Lent. It's sort of a deeply spiritual thing, but it also frees my head up a bit. You see what happens with this on social media. What do you do? How do you respond when you see slander and gossip on there, and it's speaking about someone that you know? What do you do with that? By the way, the courts are dealing with that. It's very easy to get done for any of these things, but that's by the by. What do you do? Well, it is a hard one to push back on, but we've got to move from being passive to being proactive on this. One thing that you can do is simply refuse it. In other words, don't be a garbage can. Put your lid on somebody else's rubbish. And you can do that early in a conversation. Let me use an illustration. Can I use Beth and Peter for this one? Thanks. I used someone else in the first service. There's no element of truth to this. I tried to change the names, but now you know who it really is. Yeah, imagine you're getting out of your car in the car park out there, and you hear this car door just bang shut, and you turn around and Beth's looking a bit fiery, and she's coming into church, and then in the prayer meeting in your small group that week, you're praying, you're sharing with your group, we need to be praying for Pete and Beth. I'm just not sure how they're doing at the moment. No one asks how you know or what you do with that. So it probably goes on to the prayer chain, gets even bigger than Ben-Hur, and no one says it, but someone goes and asks and says, are you guys doing okay? Oh, why? On basis of what? You see, the reason the car door slammed shut was because we're getting one of those big northerlies that blow hoot through here. She got out of the car and let the car door go and just goes bang, slammed shut. There's nothing wrong with the marriage at all, but guess what's happened? And every time you see them, every time you see Pete look at Beth with a bit of a frown, a bit of a scowl that he does every now and then, they're right. There's something going on there, but you don't actually go to them and say, "Look, you guys doing okay? I'm just concerned for you. My heart goes out to you. You know, you're not doing well," and you find out it's just a windy day. How often do you see that take place? And it's rumor, innuendo, and gossip. So you have a choice simply to put a lid on that. And the thing that I do, and sometimes it's hard because sometimes people will talk to me because they figure I'm the pastor and I need to go and fix something. But one of the things that I'll do is I'll simply ask them. So someone will ring me up and say, "Tone, can I come and have a talk with you in the office?" "Yeah, that's fine." They come down, they sit down, they talk with me. He said, "Have you been talking to Pete and Beth lately?" I said, "Oh, why is that?" "I'm just wondering how they're doing." I said, "Well, why is that?" And they said, "Oh, the door's down there. I've been looking at them. Pete scowls every now and then." I said, "Have you talked to them about this?" "No." I said, "Well, I don't want to hear the rest of the conversation." Because that's what you're meant to do. You're meant to go and talk to someone and say, "How are you guys doing?" They say, "Well, Tony, that's your job. You're the pastor." So, no, it's not. But I tell you what, if you can't go, I'll come with you. Now, that's a really neat thing in Asian nations, because there's a shame thing with Asian nations. And so if you're just to confront, that would be shaming them as well. So what they do is, and when I was teaching some of this in China, I talked to my interpreter and said, "How do you do this in China?" They said, "Oh, we do it differently." They said, "We find a mutual friend that love each other, and we bring them with us, and they're not so that they strengthen my argument. They're there as someone who's going to speak into this, and they talk on my behalf because I value the relationship with my friend, but I don't want to shame them, so my friend will do it for me." We call it something else, but that's what works for them. So if you're sitting in my office and you say, "Look, I'm just worried about such and such," you need to be aware I'm going to say to you, "Listen, you probably need to pull up there unless you've gone and met with them." And if someone says, "Well, you know, no, I haven't," I say, "Well, let me come with you." And they say, "Well, no, I don't want to do that either." There's a big part of me that there identifies the motive. And the motive is not to build them up. The motive is not to look after Pete and Beth. The motive is something else, which I don't really know what that might be. You see, that's what gossip and slander is. It's not about building up the person. Nehemiah was in a situation where that certainly wasn't happening, and it could easily put his life at risk. And so one of the other things that you can do is in refusing it, you also address it. And I'm not always really good at this. I got a phone call from a mate of mine one day, and he's not in this setting, and he said, "Tone, I don't know what you've been doing down there, but you've really upset this person." I said, "Oh, tell me about that. What does that look like?" He said, "Well, they came to me and they said that you've taken over the kitchen." I said, "What's that?" It had something to do with it wasn't the coffee this time. It was something to do with the sugar bowls. I'd upset somebody about the sugar bowls. And I wasn't man enough to confront someone in about a particular sin, and the list went on. I had a big head because I got offered a position in another church environment, denominational setting, and in my sermons I'd be dropping names all the time. And I thought the only person that worth dropping is the Queen. I met her once, and she's, Liz is just lovely. So I'm not sure what names I'd be dropping, and on it went. And someone had left the church because they didn't like my teaching. I thought, well, you know, he says, I don't know what you've done to upset them, and I'm sitting there thinking, wow. So I need to talk to this person. I was grieved. I was feeling pained, and a little bit more than that, I was feeling a few other things as well. And so I had to wait for a little while and get that sorted in my head. And anyhow, one day after church, and they were in the car park, and I went up to them, and I had to check my heart and make sure I was doing all right with God and didn't want to hit them over the head with something. And I said, look, I had a mate of mine call me, and they said that you're upset with me about all this stuff. And I said, can we do coffee? So they said, yeah. Actually, I didn't let them know at that point that I'd had this phone call. I just said to them, look, can we do coffee? So I didn't, and I sat down, and we were doing coffee, and I said, I heard there's something about the sugar bowls, and I'd taken over the kitchen, and I went through the list, and I could see a jaw drop, and I said, look, it grieves me that I've upset you, but what grieves me more is if you've got a beef, just come and see me. I hope I'm not that intimidating, because if I am, then what I want you to do is get someone else to come with you and sit down, we'll talk this through, because this affects the whole body together. Because in my head, if that's what they're telling a friend of mine, what are they saying to someone who isn't my friend? And when you've got a friend like that, and they're dumping on you, the thing in your head you've got to be thinking is, what are they saying to others about me? If they're saying stuff about someone else to me, and I'm absorbing that, and I'm opening the lid of my garbage can, it doesn't build trust at all. It doesn't build unity. And so for Nehemiah, this was not only life-threatening for him, but also for the kingdom plan. By the way, we sort of worked it out, and I said, look, I need to apologize if I've offended you in whatever way. It grieves me, and we just need to do relationship better. And so if you've ever got, you know, if I start taking over the kitchen again, just come and see me. You see, when you deal with stuff like gossip and slander, this was on a national level. But we see it on personal levels, within congregations, within communities, online. Nehemiah's response, hello. He said, I replied, there is no truth in any of your story. You're making up the whole thing. They're just trying to intimidate us, imagining that they could discourage us and stop the work. What's he do? So I continued the work with even greater determination. It just fired him up to go harder. And as the work of God was challenged, you see, this is the thing. Sometimes you can't defend yourself. You just have to wave the white flag and keep doing what you're doing. And that's what Nehemiah did. He wasn't going to be distracted from the work that God had called him to do. He was going to wait upon God and to finish the work. And they got it done. When you go to the end of the chapter, and this is where we'll come back to, in chapter 6, verse 15 and 16, we'll come back to the middle bits. It says in verse 15, so on October the 2nd, the wall was finished just 50 days after we'd begun. When our enemies and the surrounding nations heard about it, they were frightened and humiliated. What had they wanted to do to Nehemiah and the people? Frighten them. When the wall was completed in 51 days, that's about the same time or shorter than what it takes to go from Babylon, where they were, across to Jerusalem. It's an amazing job they finished. And then he says this, they realized this work had been done with the help of our God. And that's an overarching theme through all of Nehemiah. They got the wall done. Yes, it took people on their hands and knees picking up bricks. It took Nehemiah to show leadership and in the midst of slander and gossip to press on and do what he does. But ultimately, it was God that got the work done. And that's a good lesson for all of us, yes? Okay, that's fine.